Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Honesty, integrity, communication skills, relational skills.
What makes a good leader?
John is in a basement mixing up the medicine. I'm on a pavement thinking about the government.
In conventional usage, when we talk about a good leader, we usually mean a moral leader.
What does a good leader need to be?
What does a good leader need to do?
I've always thought that one of the good mantras for leadership is that you always share credit and you accept blame.
Our guest is Deborah Rohde from the Stanford Law School.
The leaders who are truly both effective and ethical are the ones who inspire.
Girl by the whirlpool's looking for a new fool. Don't follow leaders or watch your parking meter.
Not everybody is capable of being Mother Teresa, but I think everybody can be taught to be more effective.
Leadership, coming up on Philosophy Talk.
After the news.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of 91.7 KALW, local, innovative public radio for San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the beautiful Stanford campus.
And from that oasis of thought, we migrate to this oasis of the air, and from the air to the internet via our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blogo. Go check it out.
Right, and maybe now that the spring quarter's over, Ken and I will actually find some time to write some blogs. That would be nice.
Yeah, it would be.
Exercise some leadership, which, by the way, is the topic of today's show. Leadership. Ken, what is a leader? What's a good leader? We should make some fundamental distinctions, and here's one. Tell me, was Hitler a great leader or not?
Well, Hitler was certainly an effective leader. I mean, in one sense, he led millions of people in a great nation to consequential outcomes. Of course, it was disastrous. It was morally disastrous. So I don't know. I mean, he was effective but not ethical, not moral. So I would think you would want both components for a truly great leader.
But at least now we've got a distinction between the effectiveness of leadership. Does this guy take you where he wants to go? And moral leadership is the place he's taking us worth going
to.
Yeah,
right. Suppose now, there's another question you might ask. I mean, who are the great leaders? I mean, if I lined up a bunch of potential leaders and said, okay, John, pick out the great leaders, the guys and gals, the folks who are going to be great leaders, what qualities would you look for in them?
Well, that's an interesting question. And you know, if we get away from the political sphere, the sphere of people that need to be elected, it's very interesting. I mean, take computers. Would I have picked out Bill Gates in 1980 as a great leader? Probably not. I would have put whatever money I had in Microsoft, and I'd have a lot more now. He doesn't strike one as a great leader when you think of, you know, Churchill and Roosevelt, but he's been very effective within the computer world.
Is that because you think he's like got the charisma of a rag doll? I mean, he's not a very charismatic guy.
It's a little unfair to rag dolls.
but you know, there's this distinction that goes back to Max Weber. Max Weber talked about charismatic leaders, right, who will work outside any kind of fixed institutional or bureaucratic context, who have to like start a movement. And they do so not by any antecedent authority, but just by their own charisma. There are charismatic leaders, but there are also leaders that work within a bureaucratic setting and who have the bureaucratic responsibility behind them. They already have a certain kind of authority, and you want them to be effective in exercising that authority. That might not take much charisma.
Well, I think that's a good point. We got another good distinction now between leadership roles that require charisma and a lot of other things like that, and that's maybe our ordinary conception of a leader or Churchill or somebody. But then you got people like Eisenhower or you know, Bill Gates, I suppose, that are very good at working within a system, within a bureaucracy, at seeing opportunities of influencing people on a one-to-one basis to do what they need, but aren't the greatest speech givers and crowd installers in the world.
And then there are parents. I mean, they're kind of betwixt and between, right? The family is not like a bureaucratic organization, but it's not like starting from scratch either. It's kind of complicated. Look, there are many different kinds of leaders, many different settings in which leadership might be exercised, and our roving philosophical reporter, Polly Stryker, found a very unusual leader. She files this report.
It's one thing to lead in the military, in government, or in business, but try leading the homeless.
I'm homeless because I dropped out of society. You know, I lived in Miami. I was a, you know, sous chef, and then I got into drugs, and everything just went bad from there. It really did.
Well, sometime it's this bus, like the Mission Line bus, that let people ride all night when they can't get into the shelter. And I, like last night, I didn't go to sleep last night.
Well, religiously, we say, well, everyone was made in the image and likeness of God. So there's that of God in everyone, everyone, the homeless person, the person that's in jail, the person that's out on the gallows, that all people have goodness in them and probably more goodness than the opposite.
Father Louis Vitali leads the homeless at St. Boniface Church in San Francisco's infamous Tenderloin District.
Personally, I believe that the best leaders are people who draw people together and draw from that words of what we can call authority, insight, inspiration. In terms of politics or, generally speaking, lay leadership, it's simply seen as some character that they have. And generally, it's based on personal talents. An example that was commonly given was John Kennedy had a certain charisma in the sense that he had some talents that probably most people didn't have.
So where does charisma fit into church leadership?
In church view, it's something that comes from the Holy Spirit. It's a gift from God. So someone has kind of special gifts, special graces. We have a term we use, donus regiminis, the gift of office, that one gets a certain gift with the position that enables them to kind of have a little extra wisdom there. And I felt that, to be very honest about it, one gift that I felt that I had was not to be critical.
Father Vitali started a program at St. Boniface that allows the homeless to sleep in the church pews during the day while activities go on around them.
I do believe that, you know, the poor have a special grace because they don't have as many distractions, you know, and I think they cling more to other people than they do to their bank account or whatever, and that to me is healthy.
Father Vitali says Cesar Chavez really inspired him as a leader.
I went to him and listened to him speak of fasting when he was doing long fasts. I visited him and was able to hear from him what inspiration it gave him and how it helped him to discern directions of leadership. He really tried to draw from the grassroots campesinos, the ones who were the workers, struggling to raise their families in a new country and all of that. And he tried to draw from them, and that was his inspiration. It was very inspiring to me. It was leadership coming from the roots.
So what does he focus on in order to lead the homeless?
Well, one of the major things in terms of working with people and trying to provide some leadership in a community like this is to give people a sense of esteem. I don't think anybody can really lead unless they have some sense of confidence in themselves, because you're asking people to do something or move in a certain direction. So you have to have some confidence that you're able to do that yourself.
What's the most difficult thing about this position of leadership?
There are times when you fail, lots of them, you know, lots of them, especially when you're working with people like this population and you want to see them do well. And you know, addictions are just so overwhelming, and they're so destructive, and they're so hard to do anything about. That would probably be the most discouraging thing, is how many times you set up to really do something with someone, and they seem to be really eager to do it, and then it's just too overwhelming for them.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Polly Stryker.
Thanks, Polly, and thanks, Father Vitali, for that interesting piece. I'm John Perry, and with me is Ken Taylor.
And we're joined today by Deborah Rohde of Stanford University, where she is professor of law and director of the Center on Ethics. She's recently edited the book Moral Leadership. Deborah, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks for having me.
Hi, Deborah. John Perry here. In the introduction to your recent book, you borrow a question from Machiavelli. Can one be a good leader in terms of effectiveness without being a good leader in terms of morality? So what was Machiavelli's answer, and what's yours?
Well, Machiavelli wrote a whole treatise on how to be effective without being ethical, and, you know, it's still a textbook classic. My own view is that there is a difference between ethical and effective leadership, and, you know, you all pointed to examples in your introduction. We can think of them: Hitler, Stalin, Saddam Hussein, you know, people who were doing the wrong things very well and very effectively.
Well, they were doing the wrong things very well and very effectively. But if you say a good leader, I mean, can't you just Can't you mean that in two different ways? Isn't it just ambiguous right. between an effective leader and a moral and I suppose if you're a moral leader but ineffective, you're not a good leader, right?
Well, good's an ambiguous term. It can either mean effective or it can mean moral. And I think in conventional usage, when we talk about a good leader, we usually mean a moral leader and someone who is ethical in means and ends.
So if we've got this dilemma, people say leadership can't be taught, but are we going to have more luck finding the natural leaders and teaching them to be good or finding the good people and teaching them how to lead?
Well, you know, I'm kind of in the middle on that one. I think that people come to leadership challenges with a different array of skills, and some because of background and natural assets, or, you know, special grace, if you want to borrow from Luis Vitale's term, are more likely to rise to the challenge than others. But I think everybody can be taught to be more effective. And part of the skills that you're teaching are exactly the ones that the interview suggested, ways to draw people together and draw from them their best aspects. And I think, you know, and a lot of people mistake leadership for position or power or status. Really, leadership is a relationship, and you can't lead unless you have followers. And while it's true sometimes you can coerce people to do the right thing, the leaders who are truly both effective and ethical are the ones who inspire. They're not the ones who coerce.
Yeah, I think you're right, but I want to give Machiavelli just a little bit more of a hearing just for a minute. I mean, you know,
he can't defend himself.
Yeah, he was thinking about how to control a state, how to govern a state, right? And and he seemed to believe that a prince who let considerations of morality get in his way was going to be an inept prince. I mean, so can't there be situations in which, I mean, you're charged with the responsibility of leading a polity, a corporation, a family, or whatever, and that's your responsibility, to get this polity or whatever through the day. And sometimes you have to lie, cheat, swindle to do it. And wouldn't a great leader do those things as necessary? I mean, suppose you had a fickle populace, and you were going to take them to war, and they were just too fickle to make the hard choice. Maybe you'd think, I'll deceive them. You know,
yeah,
I'll lie to them.
I politics involves compromise. One reason why I like directing an ethics center rather than running for office is because, you know, you can be a lot purer from an ivory tower than you can in the real world. But you used a few verbs there, swindle. I think different people would draw the line in different places. And sure, almost all of our effective presidents have made some decisions that, in retrospect, I think even they would wish that they hadn't had to make from a purely ethical standpoint. It was necessary to govern. But I think the real test of leadership comes in knowing where the boundaries are and at what point you're willing to step over, and which ones really, you know, you can't cross there without losing your soul and without losing your integrity and your capacity really to inspire.
Well, we don't want to just focus on political leaders, but I do want to get my two cents in. People often think about Roosevelt, who more
right,
or less
exactly.
cajoled the American people into World War II, and people think that was a good thing. But then if you look at the broader spectrum, people like, I mean, I don't think Woodrow Wilson's getting us into World War I was the greatest thing in the world, not to mention more recent wars we've been pushed into. So sometimes these great leaders might be better if they weren't such great leaders and just kind of listen to the people instead of fooling them, in my humble opinion.
Well, you know, I think you're right. Michael Walzer, a famous philosopher, wrote an article about dirty hands and, you know, sort of how dirty can they be while still being effective. And I think with the benefit of Monday morning quarterbacking, we can all look back on some of those decisions and say, you know, maybe that was the wrong choice at that point. But I think Walzer's main point was you both have to give some latitude to leaders to make those hard calls, but then hold them accountable on moral grounds when they make them wrong. And that's the test for us as a public, I think.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our subject today is leadership. Our guest is Deborah Rohde from the Stanford Center on Ethics.
We've been talking about the role of ethics and morality in defining leaders and leadership. In the next segment, we'll ask about the qualities of mind, heart, and spirit that make for good leaders. You can join us by calling 415-841-4134. Outside the Bay Area, please talk really loud.
No, or call toll-free at 1-800-525-9917. True leaders, their qualities of mind and heart, plus your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
Following the Leader from Walt Disney's Peter Pan, now the official theme song of Fox News. This is Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Our musical standards are taking a dive here. Our topic today...
I thought that was wonderful.
Our topic today, leadership. What qualities of mind and or spirit does it take to be a good leader? Have you ever had leadership thrust upon you? Did you rise to the occasion or fail to rise to the occasion? Let us know.
The number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Outside the Bay Area, call toll-free at 1-800-525-9917. And finally, you can email us at comments@philosophytalk.org.
Our guest, Deborah Rohde from the Stanford Center on Ethics. Deborah, in Twelfth Night, Shakespeare has Toby Belch say, "Some men are born to greatness, some achieve greatness, and others have greatness thrust upon them. Substitute leadership for greatness." And, you know, and that suggests something to me, that there's maybe no one thing that all great leaders have in common. There may be no way to distinguish leaders from non-leaders. It's all about the situation and what we find in ourselves. What do you think about that idea, that there's really no one thing there?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think, some are more situational. Some create their own situations. They don't just let life happen to them. They happen to things. And it's probably a mix. But, you know, I think it's kind of interesting that we've gone this far without talking about the moral meltdowns in leadership that have really propelled this topic to the centerpiece. I mean, there are now 47,000 Google sites on moral leadership out there, and some of that has to do with the $7 trillion losses in shareholder value as a result of people who didn't have those qualities suddenly, you know, having greatness thrust upon them in Enron et al. So we've had some real failures in moral leadership of late.
Are there structural problems here as contradictions, as Hegel might say, to bring a little philosophy into it, between what makes a person rise to leadership in a corporation and what makes a person a truly good leader in taking the moral dimension into account in politics and in business? Are there just some contradictions built into the way it works?
Well, there's certainly a real structural problem in the capitalist enterprise, which oftentimes makes short-term profits the be-all and end-all measure of leadership. And, you know, that can have a highly corrosive effect on leaders, especially if that's the, performance is too tightly tied to those short-term profit incentives. And we see where that's gotten us with Tyco and Enron, et cetera. You know, there's the great phrase that Hannah Arendt coined to describe Eichmann in the trials in Jerusalem after World War II, the banality of evil. And she pointed out that there are a lot of folks out there who, you know, just seem indifferent to moral consequences. It's not that they're enormously evil in some intentional sense. They just find themselves within corrosive structures and they just get along to go along.
Now, I mean, so we think about the problem of leadership as how do we teach leaders, how do we find leaders, but these more structural things I think are worth spending a little time on. People at Enron are criticized because they didn't take the shareholders into account. They weren't fair to the shareholders. And there is kind of this conception of what's good in a corporation is what's good for the shareholders. And the corporation is kind of this person. But I mean, it should go beyond that, right?
Well, they thought they were good in the very short-term sense because shareholders often pay attention to quarterly profits. They weren't taking the long view, and they deceived a whole lot of people. It was a house of cards enterprise. And, you know, so they're stakeholders, too. It's not just shareholders, but it's employees, it's the pension holders, it's the people who deal with Enron, and all the people who were affected when you went from the seventh largest company to a bankrupt shell. Look, it's a huge set of costs.
Deborah, I really want to delve a bit more into this failures of leadership and what and whether it's a situation, whether it's in the followers, whether it's in the leaders themselves. But I'm still wondering about what the qualities. I mean, if I just lined up a bunch of people and I said, oh, okay, I want a guy who's going to lead, be an effective leader in this or that context. Is there something substantive that we can say in advance about what it takes? Is there some psychology, some particular set of character traits? I mean, other than just saying they'll be a good leader. I mean, I want to know whether they're going to be a good leader, so I want to know kind of in non-question-begging terms, what are the features of mind or heart or whatever? I mean, is there something systematic to say about that?
Well, yeah, people who study this are of different views. For a while, there was what was called the great man theory of leadership. Oftentimes, they weren't using it generically either. But the notion was that you could distinguish on the basis of traits certain qualities. So integrity would be one if you want to talk about effective and ethical leadership, communication skills. You know, some people would add in honesty. Some people would add relational skills, the capacity to understand where others are and to bring out the best qualities in those individuals. But I think we oftentimes underestimate the extent to which there are situational influences as well on people's ability to be effective leaders. And we have to pay attention both to the traits and the structures within which the people operate.
Right. So there have to be certain kind of enabling structures that enable people with certain character traits to do this thing, to lead effectively and morally.
Yeah, and one of the things that social psychologists have found is that it's so easy to make the good go bad if the pressures, peer pressures, time pressures, situational pressures are sufficiently intense. There's this whole wealth of clinical studies that show, you know, even Good Samaritans, seminary students en route from a lecture on Good Samaritanism won't behave like one. They'll step over somebody who seems to be dying on the pavement if they're late for their next lecture. So even people who sort of by definition have good traits, if they're placed under certain kinds of situational pressures often don't rise to the occasion.
You're listening
Go ahead.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking with Professor Deborah Rohde of the Stanford Ethics Center on Ethics. You can join our discussion by calling 415-841-4134. And Bill in Palo Alto's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Bill.
Oh, I'm glad to talk to you. I think that nothing has been watered down more than the word leader. When I was a boy, we played Follow the Leader. That was the last time I ever saw a leader. When I was in the Army, the commanders, when physical training had to be done, they would pull one of us out of the group, stand him in front of us, and have him do the physical training leadership. So what we really have in this country, and I shouldn't say just this country, all over the world, is we have managers. If a person is going to tell another person to do something, he should do it himself or be able to do it.
Bill, thanks for the comment. Deborah, I think that Bill's getting at something like this distinction that Weber had, charismatic. I mean, most of us think of leaders as charismatic people. But you put people in kind of bureaucratic settings, and what they do is exercise the authority that comes with that bureaucratic position, and often it's not very charismatic. Is that not? Bill seems to be saying that's not a kind of leadership at all. What do you think?
Well, I agree, and I think a really good test for capacity for leadership is our leaders, the military phrase is sharing the hardships of the troops. Are they asking people to do things that they're willing to do themselves? And one of the corrosive aspects, I think, about the modern capitalist structure is, you've got CEOs who are making 1,000 times the wages of the average worker. And when their company's going down the tubes, they're still taking, huge bonuses. And that kind of culture doesn't yield a lot of loyalty on the part of subordinates. And so it's not a good leadership style. You really have to, I think, live it as well and model it and be willing to put yourself out there. And, not that you want to totally level compensation structures, but, you can't be a hypocrite and be an effective leader. Hypocrisy is the bow vice plays to virtue, but it isn't a good leadership style.
Well, those are good points. I want to go back to something you said earlier about the situation. I think that's very important. When I think of leaders, the ones I'm most familiar with are university leaders, and we've been blessed with some very good leaders at Stanford. But I think of, say, Dick Lyman, He was, I thought, the perfect man for the situation into which he was thrust back in the anti-war days and a lot of campus unrest. With all due respect to Dick, I'm not sure he would have been the perfect leader for a lot of other situations that university presidents encounter. I don't know if he was the best person in the world at attending to bureaucratic details and getting budgets balanced. On the other hand, Kennedy seemed like a perfect leader for almost any situation, but then a situation came along for which he, you know, really wasn't quite ready. So it is a very situational thing. And turning out historically to have been a great leader, I think, is largely a matter of luck. Without World War II, Winston Churchill would have just been kind of a series of important failures.
Right. Well, you know, what's the Chinese proverb? We should live in difficult times. That's when people rise to the challenge.
Or fail to rise to the challenge.
Well, exactly.
Yeah. Jason in San Ramon's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Jason.
Thank you very much. Great topic, by the way. And probably I can't think of a better era that needs to be talking about it more than this era right now. But as opposed to Machiavelli and his views, I would certainly offer like Plato and his four chief virtues for like the governance of a city, wisdom, justice, temperance, and courage, as qualities that I think every leader should possess. And the last caller brought up a point that I somewhat disagree with, that necessarily a leader has to be able to do that job of the person that they're leading. I've always actually liked the aspect that the Army has kind of like adopted, and that as their junior ranks come up, they go E1, E2, E3, then they split. You become either a specialist for your E4 or you become a corporal for your E4, and one is necessarily considered a leader and the other is necessarily considered what we'd say technically a technical expert in their job. But then there's another aspect to leadership per se. I think there's a qualitative definition to it, that it is either good leadership or bad leadership, and not necessarily either you're effective or you're morally somehow good leader. Last point, it seems like when you played that clip from Peter Pan, not Peter Pan, but from Pinocchio, It was Peter Pan. Yeah.
Peter Pan. Yeah, yeah.
It got me thinking about Alice in Wonderland.
Yeah, let's get our scholarship straight here.
Me thinking about Alice in Wonderland and, you know, the walrus and the carpenter leading these oysters basically to eat them.
So are you making a comment about our current political situation there?
But it just seems very peculiar that we could even on some level say that that's good leadership just because it was effective.
That's very good comments, Roger. I especially like the
Jason.
Idea that the Army has...
That would be Jason, not...
That would be Jason, right. The Army has this structure that divides things. Let me, since I mentioned Roger, let me throw in an email from Roger in San Francisco. Please discuss what it takes to be a good follower. Isn't it intrinsically bad to be seeking leaders to make decisions that should be made by autonomous individuals for themselves? What is the responsibility of the follower when he or she differs from the leader as to means or objectives? So certainly in a democracy, to be a follower isn't just to follow. It's to question authority a lot of the time.
So, Deborah, what do you think about either Jason's comments, by the way, for which we thank you, John, Jason, or Roger's comments?
Well, there's a lot there. In thinking about the general distinction, it's not always you want to be able to do that task yourself. But I've always thought that one of the good mantras for leadership is that you always share credit and you accept blame. And, you know, most people's instinct is to do exactly the opposite. And it seems to me that the truly good leaders, and I'm thinking of university context, are the people who know really how to do that. And you know, so I would put that out there as one of the capacities that's really important. And I think it is essential to focus on what's now got its own little school of research, followership. And we spend some time, I teach legal ethics, and I spend a lot of time in classes talking about when it is appropriate to get off the boat and what learning, getting people to think about the context before they actually find themselves in one where they're really not willing to be the follower. And if a lot more professionals had taken that view in Enron and Tyco, we wouldn't be in the mess we are.
So do we need to have a center for followership at Stanford?
You know, I can't imagine the funding would just flow that naturally. You'd have to have if you're willing,
you'd have to have a fellowship.
You're listening to Philosophy.
Yeah, good.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about leadership with Deborah Rohde from Stanford's Center on Ethics. You can join our discussion by calling 415-841-4134, or outside the Bay Area, you can dial 1-800-525-9917. Paul in San Francisco's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Paul.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. And, you know, I'd just like to say, you know, it seems to me that, you know, our society at large is being subjected en masse to this, you know, huge exercise in being followers. And, I'd like to see more leaders and less followers, actually. But my question for your guest is, what about situations in which the interests of the leaders contradict the interests of the followers? And, you know, it seems to me that an effective leader needs to avoid even the appearance of a conflict of interest with those whom he or she leads. And so I wanted you to talk about that, and also, you know, just to pick an example of, you know, a leader, you know, Bush is, you know, is he, you know, do his interests contradict those, you know, those of us, the people?
Thanks for the question, Paul. This is a good question. I mean, Aristotle and Plato, those old Greek guys, say that the leader leads not for his own sake, but for the sake of those whom he leads. So he's like a doctor who administers to his patients for the patient's sake, not for his own sake. I mean, what do you think? Can a true leader really have a conflict of interest between himself and or herself and those whom he or she leads?
Well, you know, I think we can't be overly platitudinous or Panglossian in what we expect for people. Not everybody is capable of being Mother Teresa. And, you know, some sorts of conflicts of interest are built into the situation. And what we need to do from a policy standpoint is try to create structures and legal enforcement compliance systems that minimize the conflict of interest between the leaders and the followers. And, you know, we haven't done a very good job of that in the corporate setting. And, you know, politics is a whole nother set of problems there. So I think we've got to do the best we can to minimize those conflicts of interest. And then I think we have to hold individuals accountable without expecting that everybody in a leadership role is going to always be able to act altruistically. Sure, you know, we'd like everybody to be Mahatma Gandhi, but, you know, even he had his own agenda. So I think we can't be utterly unrealistic about everybody's need for status and influence and whatever currency they take it.
Christopher in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Christopher.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for having me on. Just like to relay a story that involves me in a leadership position. For the last presidential election, I was a district manager in the city of San Francisco during the elections. It was my job to oversee the precincts to make sure that there were no voting improprieties and to make sure that the voting machines were working properly and that all the precincts were running smoothly. And I had some difficulty in one of the precincts with some of the worker, actually one particular worker, who during the election process, one of the machines had become jammed. And as we were taking the ballots out of the machine and reloading them, he was making some wisecracks about, oh, this votes for, you know, Gore, this one's for, you know, basically saying, you know, that all the votes were for Gore. And, you know, he was really compromising the whole voting process. And I had to warn him twice about doing that while there were voters there. And this man wouldn't stop doing that. And so I found myself in a situation where I had to tell him, you know, hey, man, thanks for coming, but you have to go now. And I called in a different person to replace him. And the person who I reprimanded started to tell me, oh, I'm a lawyer, this and that. And, you know, how dare you do this to me? And I said, look, you know, if you're a lawyer, you should know better than to talk about these kind of things while we're in the voting process. And I basically made him go home. And what was funny was that the new person who came was kind of like some 18-year-old surfer guy who came in last minute. And he was like, oh, no, it's cool, man. I'll just go home and, you know, it's all right. Don't worry about anything. And I basically had a mutiny on the bounty, and I had to tell everybody to calm down, do their jobs. You have to leave. you're staying and doing your job, and that's that.
Well, Christopher, it sounds like you rose to the occasion. Congratulations.
Yeah. We'll discuss this more when we come back after a short break. You're listening to Philosophy Talk this week, Leadership. Our guest, Deborah Rohde from the Stanford Center on Ethics.
The Sinceros and Take Me to Your Leader, a song that raises the interesting question, is our leadership crisis in this country due to a lack of good music about leadership? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're discussing leadership with Deborah Rohde from the Stanford Center on Ethics.
Can effective and ethical leadership be taught, or is it just something you need to have a knack for? How do we enable those with a knack for leadership to actually lead?
Join us. Call 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134.
Outside the Bay Area, call toll-free 1-800-525-9917. Or finally, you can email us comments at philosophytalk.org.
So, Deborah, before the break, we had Chris telling us how he rose to the occasion. Do you have any comments you wanted to make on his story?
Sounds like he called it exactly right.
Yeah.
It's what you'd want in a leader, and I'm regretting that my profession, the legal profession, doesn't come out very well in that story. Of course, that's no surprise to lots of folks.
Yeah.
Whereas they're right down there at the bottom in terms of both ethics and leadership, although, you know, we keep putting them in positions of influence.
So, look, think about this, rising to the occasion. I mean, and we've talked about this a bit. We talk about failures of leadership. But, you know, in some situations where we accuse somebody of failure of leadership, there's at least as much fault in the followers as other. I mean, how do we decide in a situation whether it's leadership that's failed, whether it's the followers that failed, whether there weren't the enabling conditions to enable effective leadership? I mean, help me think about that stuff.
Well, when you have a massive moral meltdown, it's usually some problem of all of the above. And there were a lot of people asleep at the switch in terms of government regulators and shareholders and stakeholders. There are a lot of folks responsible for the latest wave of corporate scandals. And that's been pretty much true of most of the major, ethical catastrophes of our time. And I think, you know, it's important both, you know, retrospectively to get a little sense of where the system went radically amiss so that you can fix it. But I guess my view on in analyzing these great failures of leadership is you should do it with a forward-looking perspective. How can we prevent that from happening again? And what we should be trying to avoid is making the same mistake in the same ways. We'll always make some mistakes.
So take the Enron situation, which you seem to have thought about a fair amount. I mean, what needs to be different? Is it just the guys need to be different? Now they have jerks like Ken Lay? Or is it the set of regulations that need to be different? Is it the shareholders that need to be different? I mean, what needs to be different?
Well, you really need a different regulatory structure. I mean, you know, Enron was famous for having a great code of ethics, good optics. And, you know, right after the meltdown, it went on eBay for sale with a little tagline, never been opened. And,
right.
You know, that's essentially what passed for, you know, codes and compliance. They had it all in form, but not in fact. And nobody was rewarded for doing that. Everybody was rewarded for making the numbers. So you got to change the reward structure internally, and you got to have regulators and policymakers who have more effective enforcement tools. And, you know, we've started to do some of that with the Sarbanes-Oxley legislative reforms.
You know,
but, you know, how well they're going to work really is up for grabs at this point. You have to continue to monitor it. And you've got to provide rewards and recognition for the corporations that do it well as, you know, some more serious sanctions for the ones who aren't.
You know, I have this thought, impression, I mean, maybe it's not well-grounded, and maybe you can tell me it's not, that in professional schools, when doctors take medical ethics courses, when business students take business ethics courses, maybe when law students take legal ethics courses, I mean, they think of those courses as not somehow, my impression is, they tend not to think of them as core to the curriculum, as something that's forced on them, something they have to take. Some of them probably get a lot out of it, but a lot of them don't take it. I mean, that's
right.
My
Doonesbury
impression.
Right, Doonesbury said, trendy lip service to our better selves.
Right.
Well, that's the wrong way to teach it that way. It's got to be integrated in the in the curriculum as a whole. You can't just have one course that's compulsory chapel, although as somebody who teaches the one required course, because I've been had limited effectiveness in getting all of my colleagues to put it in theirs, you know, there are better and ways, worse ways of teaching that course. And what you want to do is ground it in real actual dilemmas and teach by the problem method, use interactive strategies. You can't lecture at people. And you know, somebody famously said, you know, professional ethics is something like fidelity in marriage and kindness to small children. You can't teach it in the professional school level. And I think that misses the point. I mean, certainly you're not going to be able to affect basic character traits that people have acquired over years. But all the research suggests that young adults do grow in their capacity to recognize and respond to ethical issues. And you can give them some skills to recognize the situational pressures, the policy failures that create problems like Enron. So well, I think we've got to do that well at the professional school level and not just throw up our hands.
One good outcome of the Enron scandal is you'll have a lot of case studies about how inattention can really lead to bad bottom line results.
We've got one more caller.
Working on those.
We've got one more caller on the line. Lori in San Mateo. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Lori.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So my question is really that in light of the fact that there are many or very few leadership positions actually available even to those who want to be leaders versus the fact that most of us find ourselves in a following position, you know, is it necessary that we look at them in sort of such separate ways and you know, one, would we do better if we were teaching followership skills versus leadership skills since so many of us are going to be followers before we're ever leaders? And then, you know, are there better ways is there a better word than followership, you know, so that we're actually empowering ourselves to partake in the process? I mean, given sort of the apathy that we find in our own political system, I guess, Deborah, I'd just like to hear your comments on how to be better at contributing to the process, I guess.
Lori, thanks. But Deborah, Lori, I want to challenge one of the things you said before, because it seems to me right there are not that many positions of leadership, that is, bureaucratic institutional positions. But I think that a situation calling for leadership in many, many settings confronts us all the time.
I was going to say exactly the same thing. Everybody's a leader. You know, parents are leaders. The guy who did the election, you know, at the polls was a leader. I think it's a mistake to just think of CEOs and, you know, elected politicians as the only model out there. There are huge numbers of people. Vitaly, the father who was leading the homeless. I mean, he doesn't have a formal position there, but he's effectively leading. And I think the real challenge is to make people equal partners in a relationship that's going to, you know, get us to places that are socially responsible and serve the public interest. And everybody's got a role in that. We can't treat moral responsibility as somebody else's responsibility.
But I think Lori has a really good point. When you think about the leadership in California or the national leadership, it seems like there's so many good people out there. We could be doing a better job selecting. So it's not so much followership as leader selectionship all of us. I mean, we ought to give people better models, critical models to think about when they watch presidential debates and things like that.
Absolutely. And if we could get money out of the process, you know, so much of it is now driven by expensive sound bites. It's a subject for a whole nother show.
That is subject for a whole nother show. Well, Deborah, I'll give you one last comment before we have to say goodbye to you. What's your closing thought for us?
You know, I think probably following on that last caller's notion, I think everybody has to look for opportunities for leadership in their own lives and think about how they would want to be remembered and find good models, whether it's Cesar Chavez or Mahatma Gandhi or Albert Schweitzer or, you know, Mother Teresa. But everybody has an opportunity, I think, to both think globally and act locally and both to look for leaders when they act as citizens, but to model it in their own lives.
On that note, Deborah, I'm going to thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Our guest has been Deborah Rohde, director of the Stanford Center on Ethics, editor of the recently released Moral Leadership. It's been a great pleasure.
Thanks, Deborah. And also thanks to all the callers we didn't get a chance to talk to. And we had some really good emails we didn't get to, too. So, thanks for that input. Sometimes it's helpful, even if we don't explicitly get to it.
Yeah. So, John, where are your thoughts leading today?
Well, you know, I think leadership is a more interesting philosophical topic than I would have guessed originally. And where my thoughts are leaning is, if you think about the democratic nations like America purports to be, they've maybe, at least the European ones, they've solved the problem of avoiding tyrants, you know, and that's an important accomplishment. But I don't think we've come close to solving the problem of really finding and really good leaders. And I don't think it's training good leaders so much as training people what to look for. I think Lori's comment was really good.
I think you're right, and I agree. And it seems, and I have actually had a new series of thoughts toward the end of this. It seems to me that part of our problem is that we've bureaucratized. So one of our callers said something about, I've met many managers but not many leaders. We've bureaucratized so much, and we think of the leaders as people who occupy bureaucratic positions. And they do those positions well. And Weber made this point about that's kind of the direction of capitalist society. But, you know, I think you're right. I mean, there's still a need for what he called charismatic leadership, leadership that just rises to an occasion in a situation. And we've become so accustomed to putting these things onto the bureaucratic occupiers of positions that it's a mess, you know? So I think I'm in deep agreement with you.
Well, maybe we could write some retroactive blogs here and get some interesting discussion started.
Yeah, so this conversation, as always, continues on our blog, the Philosophy Talk, the blog, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blago, I think, therefore I blog.
You can download podcasts of our program from our website as well. For the last word on leadership, we turn to someone who's never last in a race. He's never a follower. Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, today a corporation that grabs the most profits is called a market leader. What about human leaders? Well, we live in an uncertain age, an age critical of so-called elitism, as well as an age distrustful of leadership, not to mention an age of hyper-bureaucracies. So when we talk about our human rulers, we don't talk so much about their abilities to lead, but their hands-on or hands-off management style. Hence, we get those heck of a job, Brownie, moments. Back in the 19th century, the Western world was equally uncertain. The industrial age was dawning, aristocracy on the wane, and free market capitalism on the rise. The Scottish historian and proto-sociologist Thomas Carlyle reflected the uncertainty of his times with a kind of liberal feudalism. Bertrand Russell wrote about him, quote, "There was a dislike of early industrialism, hatred of the ugliness that it produced, and revulsion against its cruelties. There was a nostalgia for the Middle Ages, which were idealized owing to hatred of the modern world. There was an attempt to combine championship of the fading privileges of church and aristocracy with defense of wage earners against the tyranny of manufacturers," unquote. Carlyle believed that a man must work and should find joy in his labor. And he believed that extraordinary men influenced history the most, more than economics, which he called the dismal science, or any other factor. He wrote, "The history of the world is but the biography of great men." This came to be known, of course, as the great man theory. Carlyle had a major influence on Friedrich Nietzsche and his whole Superman thing, which was in part a negative reaction to Carlyle. In his disapproval of capitalism, Carlyle also influenced Friedrich Engels. Carlyle lectured often and wrote a book about heroes, finding them among pagan gods, poets, writers, kings, and generals. He coined the phrase hero worship. He was also one of the people who first brought the German Romantics to the British reader, translating Goethe and Schiller, among others. He did a biography of Oliver Cromwell and Frederick the Great. For him, history was a warehouse of heroes. As soon as ideology replaced human action, civilization was diminished. Unfortunately, his belief in the glory of labor and charismatic leadership led him to write a pro-slavery essay in 1849, which lost him many admirers. Carlyle's distaste for democracy and his worship of great men eventually appealed to Adolf Hitler, who was reading Carlyle's biography of Frederick and his pathetic last days in the bunker. It used to be that leaders had moments of glory and went down in flames. Caesar was assassinated, Napoleon put in exile. Saddam Hussein, a great man wannabe, was found cowering in a hole in the dirt. So the great man theory doesn't hold much water now, though we still have great men. These days, however, greatness is generally conferred upon them after their death, as with Ronald Reagan and John Kennedy. And we don't refer to great men much anymore. These days, we prefer the term upper management. I gotta go.
That was Ian Scholes, Digging Deep, Digging Fast, the 60-Second Philosopher. Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
We owe special thanks to Devin Strolovich, Neil Van Leeuwen, Ben Timpson, and Alan Farley. Our senior consulting producer is Gordon Earle.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University, including the Stanford Humanities Center, the Office of the Dean of Research, the Dean of Humanities and Sciences, and the Provost and President.
Also, from the Friends of Philosophy Talk, the members of KALW, Local Public Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our funders.
The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.